assume Judge Cleary's just going to join us, yeah.
Good morning. For the record, Chief Judge Edward Cleary, who was recused on the first matter, have now joined the court. We have two more oral arguments this morning. Counsel, I'm going to ask you to tell me your client's name so I don't butcher it.
I'm not sure I can pronounce it correctly, Your Honor, but I will attempt to do so. It is Wat Lau, W-A-T-L-A-O, Sirthamaran. That is S-I-R-T-H-A-M-M-A-R-A-A-M.
Okay.
I know it has been spelled differently in different pleadings and different locations throughout this file.
Okay, thank you. And counsel, your client's proper pronunciation?
Pardon me?
Your client's proper pronunciation?
I am representing the law firm, so I'm representing.
I see. All right, excuse me for that. The other parties are Pong and Lee, as well as the law firm mentioned by Ms. Nordhunt. Okay, each side will have 15 minutes for argument. Appellant will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Appellant may begin when ready. But before you do so, counsel, I do want to address a recent filing that you made regarding document 105. I just want to caution you not to reference the document ahead of time, since it's not part of the record on appeal. I understand that there's a hearing set on April 19th, 2019, but for our purposes, document 105 shouldn't be referenced. Okay.
I will refrain from talking about it, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Olson, and I'm here representing the appellant. As the court knows, this is basically a one-issue appeal, and it's our position that the standard of review is the de novo standard, based on the fact that we're dealing with statutory interpretation and statutory application to basically a set of uncontested and undisputed facts. The respondent asserts that the standard here is an abuse of discretion. We agree that particular standard applies when the court has made an award or declined to make an award of sanctions on the merits, but that didn't occur here, so we believe the proper standard is the de novo standard. In a nutshell, what the issue here is, what precision is required under 549.211 and Rule 1103 in order to initiate a sanction proceeding against a litigant's attorney. We don't dispute the fact that the 21-day safe harbor period requires strict compliance. In other words, a 20-day notice doesn't cut it. It's got to be 21 or more.
Counsel, on that note then, would you agree there's a difference between a notice of intent to seek sanctions and a motion for sanctions?
Well, clearly there's a difference between the title of the document. But under the circumstances of the statute and the rule and all case authority, the purpose of the statute and the purpose of the rule is to put the other party on notice of what the offending pleadings are, or the offending arguments or offending facts, in advance to give them an opportunity to withdraw those offending pleadings, facts, and documents. That is the express purpose of the rule. And we do agree that the fact of the matter is our document was entitled Notice of Intent to Seek Sanctions. I would also note that there are quite a few cases out there where other attorneys have done the same thing, not to excuse the title on this particular document, nor is it to excuse calling it a Notice of Intent to Seek Sanctions as opposed to a motion.
Well, I think the issue then becomes if a notice of intent to seek sanctions is filed, followed by a motion, then the argument would be under 549.211 sub 4 that you need 21-day safe harbor.
I'm sorry?
you would need 21 days as a safe harbor after the motion.
Our argument is that the notice complies with, substantially complies with the requirements of the statute, even though it's not denoted as a motion.
Counsel, in the Dirdal case, didn't the Supreme Court hold that substantial compliance with the safe harbor requirements is not sufficient, that there has to be strict compliance with the rule?
I believe under the Dirdal case, the court specifically said under the facts of this case, strict compliance is not appropriate. It wasn't a general global statement that in all cases, strict compliance is required without regard to what the particular facts of the case is. So I don't think the Dirdal case is, in fact...
But doesn't the case also say that it would ignore the unambiguous mandatory statutory requirement that a motion for sanctions be separately made from other motions or requests? Similarly, here there's an unambiguous statutory requirement that the motion has to be made separately and 21 days given before it's filed. The notice of intent is a different document than the motion, so I'm still struggling to see how there was strict compliance with the rule. I guess I don't see the court's reasoning in Dirdal to suggest that the other requirements could be substantially complied with, but not that one.
The facts in Dirdal were nothing similar to the facts in this particular case. Other than this document being titled Notice of Intent to Seek Sanctions, there was full compliance. Had it been titled Motion, I don't think we'd be here.
But it's a different document than the motion, correct? They're not identical documents.
Well, the... correct. The actual motion is accompanied by a notice of hearing, whereas the notice does not identify the notice of hearing. So you're not identifying a hearing date down the road when you serve the quote-unquote motion identifying the defects in the pleadings and whatnot. That's not done. That has to be done separately once the actual motion is filed after that 21-day grace period has been given. So, again, we believe that what we're talking about here is a caption on a document controlling the statute and the rule. I don't think that's case law. I think case law says that that is not a procedural defect to have an incorrect caption on a document.
Why would substantial compliance not apply in the Dirdal case, but apply here? What would be the legal basis for distinguishing the two? And
because the Dirdal case didn't address the issue of what occurred here. The Dirdal case had all sorts of different deficiencies. Other than the fact that this document was arguably not correctly captioned, there were no deficiencies here. Now, there are some side arguments about the original document had the incorrect case file on it that referred to a prior case involving similar parties and whatnot. However, that original notice was appended to the answer and counterclaim that was served 3 weeks after the fact in September 2017. There was never any objection by the subject law firm to the fact that the document was not titled motion. That didn't come up until the actual motion was heard almost a year later. There were multiple opportunities to address any kind of deficiencies in the notice along the way. We, as the record reflects, there were multiple proceedings that were undertaken by both parties as far back as October of 2017. There was no mention of the deficiencies then, even though the notice of intent was referenced. The issues raised in the notice of intent were litigated in a summary fashion before the district court. That occurred the first week in November. It was not until we got the decision in February 2019 that we learned that the court was taking a completely different path than anyone had anticipated or even argued. That's not a not an issue with regard to this notice, however. Mr. Priest and his office were put on specific notice of what the offending problems were. The Deardall case doesn't say where, under similar circumstances, or excuse me, again, the Deardall case doesn't say in all cases there has to be strict compliance with every aspect of the statute. Again, it says under the facts of this case, which were completely different than the facts of the case in front of us. I would also and again, we believe the record supports the fact that Mr. Priest and his office were given full notice of what the problem was. It was written notice. It wasn't an oral notice. It wasn't a letter notice. It was a document that ended up in the court filed in September 2017. And therefore, we believe that the court should recognize that, quote unquote, strict compliance with the initiation of the sanction process is not required, provided the rest of the requirements are met under the statute, which they were here.
Given the plain language of the statute and rule, isn't it reasonable to expect for an attorney to expect compliance, strict compliance with that rule? So why would a notice of motion, why would an attorney reasonably interpret a notice of a motion to be the triggering document for purposes of the safe harbor rule? And the motion itself is that triggering document.
The document titled motion is, under the statute, the triggering document. However, again, the purpose of the statute, and clearly the purpose of the legislature and the judiciary, was to put the party on notice at least 21 days before any further proceedings are undertaken. And in this case, it wasn't 21 days after the fact that the motion ultimately was brought. It was 11 months later.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but, you know, I don't know that we can find that the notice of intent to seek sanctions is the equivalent of a motion, because even the first paragraph of your notice says you're going to bring the motion in a separate standalone motion, and you cite both the rule and the statute that requires the 21-day safe harbor. You know, I don't know that there's a basis for us to say, well, this was the equivalent of a motion, because you yourself, when you filed it, acknowledged you were going to file a motion.
Correct.
And you acknowledged the statutes. It seems to go, we're going in a big circle here.
My only response to that is that's the process my office has utilized for the last 20 years. We've been awarded attorney's fees and sanctions utilizing that particular process in the past. The better practice, obviously, would have been to denote the document a motion and serve it as such.
Well, counsel, there's separate steps here, though. I mean, the notice of intent to seek sanctions alone isn't the problem here. The problem is that a motion is filed later, which you may do in your other cases, but the safe harbor provision wasn't honored because you filed it the same day. So it isn't so much that the notice took you down, it's how you handled the filing of the motion and seeking sanctions.
Well, again, I think it depends upon, again, whether or not strict compliance is required with that initial pleading or not. We take issue with the fact that the motion was filed the same day as the notice. Our position is that the notice was filed well in advance of the motion. And again, there are many cases out there, unpublished in Minnesota, there are actually published decisions such as Johnson that discuss where a different sort of notice was provided. In Johnson, the letter notice and the oral notice weren't found to be defective even. The problem was the notice was given after the fact instead of 21 days in advance. The Johnson court could have very easily said, in all cases, the oral notice and the letter notice wouldn't be sufficient. But the Johnson court didn't say that. The Johnson court merely said there was no compliance with the actual 21-day advance notice requirements. And the same holds true with many of the unpublished decisions where there was either an informal letter provided that didn't become part of the court file that threatened sanctions. There was either an argument raised at a hearing saying we're going to seek sanctions. But here again, other than basically challenging the format of the notice that was provided as not being a quote-unquote motion, there was full compliance. And again, we do take issue with the fact that the motion and the notice were served on the same day. We don't believe that's the case. If you have nothing else, I'll...
Well, would the remedy then be, do you agree that, even if we agreed with you here, Mr. Olson, that we'd need to remand this to the trial court to determine whether or not a dismissal without prejudice would warrant the award of attorney's fees in any event?
Actually, the trial court would have to determine on the merits whether or not the fees are appropriate. And that would be on remand. And is the court asking me whether
Well, I think
or not
you answered my question. I mean, even if we found that the court erred in applying the 21-day safe harbor here, there still remains the issue as to the effect of a dismissal without prejudice, isn't it?
I don't think the dismissal without prejudice affects the ability to go after the fees. There is case law that says, I'm aware of case law, a number of family law venues where a case has been dismissed and a party has still been able to proceed and seek either attorney's fees under 518.14 or seek sanctions for that matter.
But the trial court didn't decide that issue, so it'd have to go back to them to make that determination.
Trial court would have to make a determination both on the merits and any other determination feels is appropriate. However, I would note that the trial court did grant our motion to proceed with the sanction process in its ruling on the amended findings. My time's up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Olson. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Nordhunt.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nordhunt, and I represent the respondents Jeffrey Priest, Richard Crabb, and the Priest Law Firm. Respondents request that the trial court's denial of Rule 11 in Minnesota Statute Section 549.211 sanctions against respondents be affirmed. Appellant's motion for its sanctions, which is at Respondent's Addendum, page 1, proceeded pursuant to appellant's motion served on respondents on July 27, 2018, and filed with the district court on that same day. Minnesota Statute Section 549.211 Subdivision 4A and Rule 11.03 Sub A Sub 1 require 21 days safe harbor after service of the motion before the sanction motion can be filed with the district court. It's a two-step process. You've served the motion, and then you wait the 21 days, and then you file the motion. Respondents objected to the motion on the ground of failure to comply with the two-step process, and the trial court agreed and denied the motion, which is in accord with the statute and the rule, and therefore it should be affirmed. Appellant attempts to skirt its problem by asserting that a document entitled Notice of Intent to Seek Sanctions, which is at Appellant's Addendum, page 24, which notice does not notably seek any relief from the court, is legally sufficient to somehow satisfy Rule 11 and 549.21. But the plain language of the rule and statute expressly requires the 21-day safe harbor provision be initiated by service of a formal motion. As one court aptly put it, close is good enough in horseshoes and hand grenades, but not in the context of a sanction motion. The notice of intent by its terms is not a motion. A motion is an application to the court for an order. The notice of intent seeks nothing from the court. In our brief to this court, we cited the 2010 unpublished decision of this court in the Murin case. In Murin, this court rejected reliance on a document entitled Notice under MnSTAT Section 549.211 as not meeting the motion requirement of the rule in the statute. In support of that ruling, this court cited two federal court cases which held that service of a notice of intent to seek sanctions does not meet the requirement of a separate motion. This notion of substantial compliance has been rejected by this court, and in the one federal circuit, there's only one federal circuit out there, that's the Seventh Circuit, and those are the cases that appellant cites in his reply brief, has allowed for substantial compliance, but it's interesting, even in that circuit, the Seventh Circuit has recognized it's made a morass out of it, and that it needs to rethink that. And I direct the court's attention to Northern Illinois Telecom versus PNC Bank, 850 Fed 3rd, 880 at 887. The fundamental problem with the substantial compliance theory is it cannot be reconciled with the actual language of the rule or the statute. And it's contrary to the clear reason for the rule as enunciated by the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 11 Advisory Committee. There, the committee warned against treating anything less than formal service of a motion as sufficient to comply with the warning shot safe harbor requirement to stress the seriousness of the motion for sanctions and to define precisely the sanction conduct that is being requested. So when you look at the case law, you look at the statute, you look at the rule, what you need is a motion. And it's very easy to comply with. I mean, there's no reason that anybody in this state doesn't comply with it because the rule is clear on its face. The court has made clear you need actual compliance, substantial compliance isn't good enough. And counsel, I ask that this court affirm the district court.
Appellant argues that the Deardahl, the court's language regarding substantial compliance in Deardahl was limited to the facts of that case. And the court does say applying the doctrine of substantial compliance in this case would ignore the unambiguous mandatory requirement that a motion for sanctions be made separately from other motions or requests. So it does reference to in this case, but what is your response to his argument that the court really was limiting its analysis of substantial compliance, the application of substantial compliance for purposes of the rule to the facts of that case and whether substantial compliance appropriately applies in this case because of your client had actual notice an intent to bring a motion in the future?
Well, it isn't limited to the facts of the case for exactly what you stated when you were reading it, because the court looked at the rule and said it's not ambiguous. We have to apply it as written. So it says motion. So I don't know how you ever can get to substantial compliance without violating the rule on its face. And you also have a statute. So, I mean, and they're the same. And so I can see no basis. And I think that's why I mentioned the Seventh Circuit, because, I mean, they're an outlier, because all the other circuits have said, you read the rule, you apply the rule. And that's what this court has done. Appellant mentioned the Johnson case. The Johnson case, one of the underlying facts is the parties were pro se when a lot of this was going on. But the court there construed a letter to be a notice of motion in motion. And there was saying, well, it was filed out of time. but it didn't in any sense deviate from this court's basic premise that you have to have strict compliance with the rule and the statute. It just, you know, viewed that this letter was, in fact, a motion. Here, the district court properly looked at the document that was presented. The second one is a motion, and there wasn't the 21 days. This other document is not a motion, and therefore there has not been compliance with the statute and the rule.
So, counsel, I have no quibble with the clear reading of the statute. My question is more procedural under the terms of this case, and it really gets to the point of what would be even the purpose of a 21-day safe harbor provision under the facts that are before us now, because the case had already been dismissed. And, you know, within a few days of the filing of the complaint that had the normal acknowledgement that, you know, if we file a frivolous complaint, we know we might get stuck with reasonable attorney's fees. So your client acknowledged that. Shortly after this complaint was filed, they got this notice. And then within a couple of months, there was a Rule 12 motion and the case gets dismissed. So what was to be accomplished by a 21-day safe harbor on the motion filed after dismissal?
Well, that's another grounds for that the sanction should be denied, because the motion was brought after it already been dismissed without prejudice. That's a separate grounds.
But, you know, as a former district court judge, had Mr. Olson, 7 days after you filed your complaint, filed a motion for sanctions, I would have looked at him and said, we just started this litigation, counsel. Your motion's premature.
Right. And I think, you know, what's interesting about the comments to Rule 11 is the fact that there was a recognition that there might be the party put on notice, you know, throughout the litigation. But that doesn't matter. What matters under the rule is the actual motion. So if you look at the advisory committee comments, they say, I mean, we actually think, you know, lawyers are going to be sending letters and sending notices of intent and all that, but we don't really care, because the cutoff, the beginning of the 21 safe harbor, is the motion.
It seems to me like we might be sending a message to the bar then, if we were to adopt that reasoning, that, you know, just to protect yourself, every time you're defending on an action and you get served with a complaint in a civil matter, you better file an immediate motion for sanctions and address that with the district court, even if the district court chooses not to hear it at that point in time. Otherwise, if you get a dismissal after Rule 12, it's too late to seek sanctions at that point, because the case has already been dismissed, and that's what you wanted to begin with.
Well, and I'm only telling you what the rule says.
Yeah, I know.
And, I mean, you know, we can quibble about how this, you know, whether Rule 11 should be written this way or 5-4. I don't know we can do anything about 549.211. I mean, that's the legislature. But the rule is the rule, and the court has recognized that throughout. And what we don't want is this idea of sitting there and deciding, well, what is this document, and was this really noticed? I mean, now we're looking at letters. What are we looking at? And that's why the rule committee, when it made this rule, said, we want a formal motion. We want it so everybody knows exactly this is it. This starts the 21 days, and that's what triggers, once upon filing, that the court can look at the sanctions. So,
but the court can initiate these proceedings on its own with the issuance of an order to show cause,
certainly,
without regard to a 21-day safe harbor after the court has dismissed the action.
The court has some inherent authority. I recognize that, but that wasn't obviously instituted here. And the district court looked at it and said, you know, no, I mean, you know, you didn't follow the rule. I'm going to deny the sanction, and I can't understand why that would be error. I mean, for the district court judge to do exactly what the rule says. So I ask that this court affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Any rebuttal?
Very briefly,
I would hope that one thing that comes out of this appeal is that attorneys in the state are going to know precisely what has to be done with regard to the initiation of a sanction proceeding, regardless of whether or not there's strict enforcement or, excuse me, strict compliance required of the statute or not. That this case is the only case I'm aware of that addresses this particular issue and this particular issue only.
Counsel, it occurs to me that a notice of intent, such as you filed, has a different goal than a motion for sanctions. A notice of intent to seek sanctions seems to me as trying to get the case dismissed early, get it out of here. I'm not really going to seek sanctions. I'm just trying to tell you that if we don't get rid of this now, I will. And then the motion for sanctions really is seeking sanctions. Would you agree there's a difference in that sense?
I agree there's a difference, but also the notice of intent, or giving the notice of intent to seek sanctions, is part of the statute and part of the rule. That's the purpose of
it. But it's not the same as a motion, even by your own agreement.
It's not the same as a quote-unquote motion. I do agree with that. However, if you look at the document, it does indicate that the motion will be brought on the grounds identified in the document, and it'll be done at a date in the future as a standalone motion, 21 days after the fact, anytime down the road. So everything else in the statute was complied with. There's no argument it wasn't. I would
but
note
the
that
the statute requires a motion, and we have to apply the plain language where it's unambiguous. And you're agreeing that the notice of intent is not the same as a motion.
It's not denoted as a motion. No, it is not.
Well, and it also doesn't request that the court take any action, as counsel for respondent noted. So I think it specifically notes that a separate motion will be brought. So it is not, I think it's fair to say it is not a motion. So given the plain language of the statute, it's not clear to me how we have any room to find substantial compliance, because the language is clear and the facts of this case show that the notice of intent is not a motion.
I believe the court does have the authority to find that strict compliance isn't required with regard to that particular language in the statute when looking at the intent of the legislature and the judiciary. And I just have one other thing to offer, and that is every one of the cases cited by counsel and the respondent law firm in this particular case have facts that aren't anywhere similar to the facts of this particular case. That includes the federal cases cited and the state cases that were cited. We addressed each and every one of those cases that were cited in our reply brief and why they shouldn't be considered as having any kind of authority in this court making a decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The matter will be taken under advisement. An opinion will issue within 90 days.